Today on Against the Grain, Americans are watching more media than ever before, but trusting it less. Why and how can that be possible? Journalist Matt Taibbi reflects on those questions in a piercing analysis of the mainstream media system, drawing on the work of Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman, as well as many decades of experience in the trenches of the press. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with Taibbi about why we should think of the media as a consumer product. Perhaps we might add one that should come with a warning label. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The media system in the United States is often celebrated for its openness and condemned for its proximity to power. However it should be characterized, it's changed a great deal since the early 1990s, with the rise of 24-hour news, outlets like Fox, and the internet, unleashing a tsunami of vitriol, but often not more insight into the world in which we live. Was the old way of ostensibly objective journalism any better? Is the present, in which journalists are under pressure to deliver corrosive content in great quantities, a break with the past? Is there another way? Journalist Matt Taibbi has taken his scalpel to the press, and the result is Hate Inc., Why Today's Media Makes Us Despise One Another. He's a correspondent for Rolling Stone and the author of various best-selling books. He joins me in studio. Matt, why do you suggest that viewing or consuming news in this country is akin to smoking?
Well, first of all, it's a consumer product. I mean, I think that's one of the things that I'm trying to do with this book is kind of raise consumer awareness. People in this country, we've become sophisticated about what we eat, what kind of cars we drive, what kind of things we do in terms of polluting the atmosphere, what kind of energy we use in our homes, but people don't think about what they're putting in their brains. And commercial news is a consumer product. It's a billion-dollar business where what we're essentially trying to do is turn attention into advertising revenue. So even though you're not forking over money every time you click on a television news program or read an article, just by virtue of paying attention long enough to see an ad somewhere, you're participating in that consumer process. And I think what people don't realize is that this is becoming a very sophisticated business that uses a lot of the same techniques that big tobacco uses. They're using basically a strategy that addicts people to an upsetting and angering experience. And, you know, there's a lot of research out there that shows that this makes people incredibly unhappy and even mentally ill. So that's one of the things that I'm trying to talk about with this book.
You write that you originally thought of writing a contemporary take on Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman's classic analysis of the American media system, Manufacturing Consent. And in that book, they argue that the media system operates not by overt censorship, but by presenting debates within a very narrow spectrum of politics and excluding dissent. Tell us what that book meant for you when you read it as a teenager.
Yeah, I read that book when I was about 19. I had grown up in the press. My father was a reporter, so my earliest memories are all about newsrooms. I thought I knew everything about journalism, but Manufacturing Consent is a real eye-opening book. And it really lays out how the censorship process in America, it's not censorship per se. It's not like it would in the Soviet Union where they come in, they red pencil your copy. But it happens really at the point of hire. If you're the kind of person who's going to raise unpleasant issues or make unpleasant comparisons, you just simply won't be promoted to a position of prominence. You're not going to be the person who gets the front page slot, and you're not going to be the person who gets to be on television reading the news. And so you take all of these cues when you're in the business about what's an acceptable story and what's not an acceptable story, and they just become ingrained in your experience. experience as a reporter, and you learn principles, and Noam Chomsky and Herman talked about some of them, like the idea of worthy and unworthy victims, right? So in the 80s, for instance, if a Polish priest was murdered by communists, Catholic priests, then that was the biggest story in the world because the communists were these dastardly people who had done this terrible thing. But if you had a Catholic priest who was murdered by death squads in El Salvador by some other American client state, that was less of a story because they were unworthy victims. And this is, nobody tells you to ignore one story and pay attention to the other, but you just sort of get it over the years. Like, what, this is what my editors are going to like, this is what they're not going to like, and you do the one story and you don't do the other. And I this happened to me when I worked overseas. I lived in Russia when I was young, and I knew that editors would like a story about anything that had to do with capitalism kind of advancing in Russia, right? So the first IKEA opening in Moscow, anyone would buy that story. The first KFC, people getting VCRs for the first time, having disposable income, going on vacations, that would sell. But if you had a story about people not getting paid their salaries by the mine owners or whatever it was, that wouldn't. And so that's kind of what that was about.
And yet, as you know, the media system has changed since the publication of Manufacturing Consent in 1988. How do you understand those changes, the changes that have taken place since the book came out, and how we might incorporate those changes into a broader understanding of the media system?
Well, there's three really big things that happened. First of all, the development of the 24-hour news cycle that started in the early 80s, but it really didn't become a big thing until the 90s. And the first Iraq War was the first real big 24-hour story. And just briefly, that created an enormous pressure on the business to come up with content. Like, before we were just doing one newspaper a day and maybe two newscasts a day, so we just didn't have to produce that much. Now all of a sudden we had to fill oceans of time, and one of the first things that networks found out is that just putting two people on air and arguing was a great way to fill time. It created the appearance of action, and people became engaged in that. That was one thing. The other thing was, commercially, the whole business was upset by the introduction by the internet. Previously, journalism made money easily. If you had a radio station or a broadcast station in a big city, it was a scarce amount of airtime for selling ads. It was almost impossible not to make money in one of those businesses if you had an FCC license. Also, the newspapers had distribution monopolies. They were the only place you could do a want ad or a big ad. So they just made tons and tons of money. The internet wiped out the distribution advantage for big media companies. And now we were competing against not just other news organizations, but people who had Sasquatch sites or whatever it was, thousands and thousands of things. And the distributors were not us, but Facebook and Google and things like that, and they got all the ad revenue. And the third thing was this discovery that, like, stations like Fox had, which is that you could make lots of money selling slanted media content and news. And they had piggybacked on the discovery, basically, in afternoon talk radio in the 70s in New York, this idea that if you didn't have to make things up, but you just picked news stories that you knew your audience was going to like, and if you just fed them stuff over and over again, that they were going to come back. And instead of going for the whole audience, you go for a small audience, you dominate it. That's an easy way to make money. So a combination of, it was harder to make money generally, and this discovery that there was a new easy way to make money fundamentally changed the business.
It's easy, it's too easy in some ways to look back nostalgically at better media days in the past, right? And imagine that, there was a golden age of fantastic journalism that has now been supplanted. But there certainly was a shift, as you're describing, and that included moving from broadcasting to large popular audiences, and then the move from that to broadcasting to particular niches. How do you understand that part of the story and the way that the tone changed from one to the other?
Yeah, that's a really, really important point. And And you're absolutely right. We don't want to lionize the way the media was before. There were tons and tons of problems. It was all white guys. They missed tons and tons of huge stories back then because they were they had all kinds of biases that weren't penetrated. But the tone, which was that sort of Lowell Thomas CBS tone of, you know, good morning, everybody. Let's get the widest possible audience. That came from a commercial strategy. It wasn't about ethics, you know, this idea of objectivity. Having that kind of neutral, unthreatening tone that the whole family could enjoy together was all about getting as many viewers as possible, and so that you could sell the most ads. In fact, that was Lowell Thomas himself when he started the first CBS radio broadcasts. He originally wanted to do something else. He wanted to play up the idea that audiences were riled up and upset by the news, and but he was told by his sponsors that they wanted to play it, quote, down the middle, so that they could sell the most ads. And so that idea that CBS, ABC, NBC, that tone that they brought to the press and that leaked into the newspapers as well, that kind of like neutral third person voice that you still see in the New York Times, it was just a commercial strategy, but it's fallen out of style now. Like if you watch cable news, they're doing something very different. They're going for an emotionally charged, heavily politicized voice that is designed to provoke a reaction on only part of the audience as opposed to all of it. And that's a big, big difference. And it's not ethically different. It's not ethically worse or better. It's just different. I think it's just more divisive than it used to be.
Do you think that the structure of the internet has exacerbated that? I mean, you can see it in broadcast television, but the internet also, in many ways, allows entities to market things to various different niche markets rather than speaking with a broad voice to a public as defined, you know,
right,
specifically Broadway.
No, you're absolutely right. The internet has accelerated that kind of atomization process. You have so many different outlets that are producing basically niche media, and they can be incredibly tiny, right? You know, from people who like to watch cat videos to, you know, to hardcore, you know, Marxist-Leninist outlets to whatever it is, or to the Drudge Report. There's something out there for everybody, and the game has become about who can put out the strongest content that keeps people coming back. And so you have to both grab the eyeballs, that's the first thing, but you have to make sure they come back tomorrow too. So it heavily emphasizes the idea that you need to have a developed relationship with your readers. Otherwise, they'll just scan the landscape and look for the next big thing. And they are doing that. They're on social media all day long looking for the thing that's the most exciting. So, you know, that pushes people towards very specific kinds of strategies to make it this kind of conspiratorial relationship between you and the audience, which is just exactly the opposite of what we were doing back, you know, in the 60s and 70s, say. And again, there were other problems back then, but they weren't doing that.
And it seems like volume is another part of that, right? That to keep people hooked, you actually have to keep producing new content over and over again.
Absolutely. Yeah, and you actually have to be afraid of the audiences leaving. Part of the original bargain, one of the reasons that people liked, for instance, the old Cronkite broadcast, and I write about this in the book, is that he very specifically had an end to the news, you know, that his famous sign off, and that's the way it is. It sort of gave people psychological permission to tune out until the next day. And it was sort of a psychological promise, like, it's okay, you can go off, do your thing, and I'll be back here tomorrow. And people were reassured by that. But you can't do that now. You have to make sure that they stay hooked. And so there's this constant pressure to create more and more content, to feed people things on social media. Nobody in the business now is ever really out of work. I mean, when they go home, they're still on Twitter, they're still on Facebook. And so you're constantly feeding people stuff, and that creates bad habits, I think, in both directions, with audiences and with content creators. It's just unhealthy. Like, we, you know, we should be paying more attention to our families and our lives, in our communities, and not being online so much.
I'm speaking with journalist Matt Taibbi. He is the author of the book Hate Inc., Why Today's Media Makes Us Despise One Another. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So it's easy to point to formal changes in the structure of how media is produced, the internet, the 24-hour news cycle, cable, television. But when you look at the changes that have happened to the media system since the late 80s, when, as we mentioned earlier, Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman published their classic work, Manufacturing Consent, are there also changes that you see to the structure of how media is funded, to the basic political economy of the media?
Well, it's still basically a consumer business. There are a couple of things about that that are different. First of all, I think back in the day, there was a widespread understanding that the news didn't have to make money. It was implicitly part of the bargain from the 1934 Communications Act. Basically, we, the government, will lease companies' use of the public airwaves, and you'll make lots of money doing that. But in return, you have to produce some content that's in, quote unquote, the public interest. So the implicit bargain was, you can have entertainment and sports and all these things, they'll make money, and the news is kind of a loss leader, and that's okay, it's a public service. But that kind of went out of style in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. We went away from the fairness doctrine. Suddenly companies felt much more economic pressure, and so now the news has to make money, and that's different from it was in the old days. And so it's less a public service than it is an out and out just another wing of most media businesses. So they look at the bottom line the same way they look at the bottom line of their other divisions. NBC is looking at its programming the same way it looks at its sports programming and its entertainment programming. It's just it has to make a number, and so that's different. When I first came up in the business, companies like ABC, CBS, NBC, they had huge bureaus overseas, and they were investing lots of money just in the process of gathering the news. And they did it because that was sort of the standard. It was just they were trying to create what they thought was an appropriate news product. Now they've figured out that they don't have to do that. They don't need to do all that work. They can just kind of create content that makes people think in a certain way, and you don't have to do all that research and reporting. It's just it's not a business expense that you need. So just the business itself has fundamentally changed. It's gone from being something that we think about as not really a functioning profit-making entity to being something else entirely.
Do you think that the relationship between the content of news coverage on commercial media and the commercials that information is wrapped around has changed? I mean, you write that in the era when there was the attempt to use this sort of neutral third-party tone to speak inoffensively to a broader audience, that part of the way that model functioned was that you couldn't have the news content be more colorful than the advertisements, because actually the advertisements were the point.
Right.
But now that you've got this super colorful, over-the-top news spectacle, how does that influence the relationship between that content and the advertising?
I think the advertisers have a problem with it, frankly. You saw this happen with right-wing media already. They went through a very troubling, and they're still going through it. But I think the first signs of this were with Glenn Beck, where you started to see widespread boycotts of certain advertisers. And a lot of advertisers don't want to be associated with heavily politicized content. And it's less of a problem with the other side, I would say, so far. But that is definitely an issue. Like the news used to be much more favorable to typical consumer advertisers back in the day, because they all wanted to be associated with people like Walter Cronkite. Walter Cronkite was the most, polls showed, the most trusted person in America for like 13 years running. So to be on that broadcast, if you were selling Windex or whatever it was, you wanted that association. Well, do you want that association with Glenn Beck these days? Do you want to be associated with Rachel Maddow in a red state? Like, I think that's that's a tougher call for advertisers. And that's one of the reasons why the business is kind of struggling right now. I mean, it's not struggling. It's making a lot of money, but it's in a different way. And you're seeing overwhelmingly that these cable shows are turning to certain kinds of advertisers, like, you know, pharmaceutical companies, where people kind of need the product, right? That's you know, a troubling thing too, because they're going to end up being dependent on only a smaller kind of advertiser, a smaller base of advertisers than they were before, which is troubling.
And yet you write that as the media has become more vitriolic, more spectacular, more partisan, but actually within a pretty broad spectrum of debate, that the profitability of media entities, media companies has gone up.
Yeah, it has, but it's kind of a catch-22. So all the studies show that people are consuming the news more than they ever have before. If you're just talking about cable, I think the number right now is something like since Donald Trump announced his run, the profits are like up 37 or 38%, something along those lines. They're doing, all three of the major cable networks are doing, you know, billions, about $1 billion in profits a year, or a little bit more. And people are watching more than ever, but surveys also show that people believe us less than ever. So what does that mean? That means they're consuming us more as entertainment than they ever were before, or as something, and that's other than informational. They need to do it. You know, they have an emotional need to see what's going on all the time. They're afraid. Maybe that's what's going on. But they don't have that kind of warm, fuzzy, trusty feeling that they used to have about the press, whether correctly or incorrectly, but that's how they used to feel about us back in the day. I know just from working in the business that people feel very differently about reporters than they used to. There's a hostility out there that I never saw before. I think it's getting worse.
It's, of course, so easy to point the finger at the Fox Newses in all of this. But I wonder if you could talk about how you see the so-called respectable press, the New York Times, for example. What role have they played in this changed media landscape in which the sensationalism has proved to be pretty profitable?
Well, I think a lot of the major, quote-unquote, respectable media, they found themselves at a tremendous kind of Rubicon kind of a moment in the summer of 2016 is when this was, people were talking about this the most. We had a problem, which was Donald Trump was making everybody lots of money. And all the networks talked about it. You even heard things like CBS executive Les Moonves saying it out loud. You know, this person's bad for the country, but he's great for CBS. He's great for the bottom line. People were kind of saying stuff like that. And I covered Donald Trump's campaign. Everybody was talking about this. Like, this guy's getting amazing ratings for all of us. We're getting clicks we never saw before. But we probably helped him get the nomination by giving him all this free press coverage. So what do we do? And there was I think what ended up happening, the New York Times did an editorial in the summer of 2016. Donald Trump is testing the norms of objectivity, I think is what it was called. And the concept was that we needed to not just think about being true, but true to history's judgment, that we needed to have copious and aggressive coverage. And so what I think this really meant for media companies was, let's not cover him any less, let's just be more negative about it, right? And that's the way we'll justify what we're doing. And so there's all kinds of things that happen in the world that are important, but if you turn on the news now, it's all Trump all the time, and that's not an accident. He is important. He's the president of the United States, but he's not everything there is in the universe, but he is for these companies, and he makes money for both the right wing and the other press. He's profitable for MSNBC and for Fox. He's the perfect consumer product for the news because he's enraging, entertaining, crazy, and you can't. He says something new every 2 seconds, so you have to keep checking. I think it's been terrible for the press. This idea that we're going to cover him so much, and to the exclusion of all else, and I think it's really radicalized audience behavior too.
what do you think is driving that? Is it the profitability of it? I mean, one can point to how Trump plays his opponents, plays the media, that while it may seem like he is setting himself up for criticism, Trump controls the narrative, and that can be repeated over and over again. So is it enough just to say, well, look, the mainstream media, including the respectable media, is being played by Trump? Or are they really very conscious about the role that he plays for them?
I think they're very conscious of it. I think certainly at the level of television executives, they're very conscious of that. And I know I don't have any evidence for this, but I can't imagine that there aren't discussions that, you know, this is great, just keep doing what you're doing. I mean, the CNN made $1 billion Trump's first year in office. The coverage strategy was all Trump all the time, all Russiagate all the time. That was a story that sold and sold and sold. And again, this goes back to what I was saying at the beginning of the interview, which is reporters don't need to be told what works and what doesn't, right? We hear loud and clear what they want and what they don't want at the editorial level. And everybody knew that, you know, everybody knows that Trump is a sexy story. If you have an angle on Trump, it's going to be waved through. And just to take an example, the operation with al-Baghdadi, when that happened, instantaneously, there were like 9 different angles to the story that were just Trump related. How did this work for Trump? Was Trump overplaying his hand? Did he inform the Democrats early enough? Was the Situation Room photo more staged than Obama's was? I mean, it was to the point of absurdity. But all that content gets clicks. So, and we're doing that to the exclusion of, well, who is al-Baghdadi? Why was that important? How is it going to change the history going forward? What do people in the region think? We're not doing that traditional stuff. We're doing it all on this other angle. And I think that's, we know what we're doing.
Let me ask you more particularly about the media that positions itself as progressive,
mm-hmm.
or even left. How do you see the role of progressive media outlets in both in the short term fueling Trump's rise, but being implicated in this turn of media to sensationalism and fostering often unproductive divisions?
Again, first of all, I think the stations that market themselves as left or progressive, we have to remember that that's first a marketing distinction and not necessarily a real distinction. Like if you look at MSNBC, or the New York Times even, well, less so the Times, but let's take MSNBC, for example. You can go a long time without seeing somebody who's genuinely anti-war on an MSNBC panel, but you won't have to go far to see a current or former intelligence official or a military officer. They're the kind of neoliberal think tanks and ex-military people. They're just, you know, it's a similar situation to what was going on in the early 2000s when we were going into Iraq. There was just this explosion of people from a certain sector of society that were just flooding all the cable channels. And we're seeing that now. CNN and MSNBC, there's just a lot of people from that particular corner of the universe who are now paid contributors. And they're talking about stories that they themselves have involvement in, which is crazy. But they market themselves to progressives. They do a few stories that I would say superficially address things that are important to progressives and liberals, but it's never to the point of being offensive to, I would say, big pharmaceutical companies. People have to realize that there's a little bit of a con going on with some of that. They're trying to hook you on certain issues by being a very, very against people who like Donald Trump, but that doesn't mean that they're for the same things that you are. So I really worry about that. I mean, that's part of the reason that I wrote the book is that the same kind of things that we started to see Fox doing in the 90s that I thought were really bad, we're now seeing on the other side with where they're manipulating audiences and informing them less.
You write in Hate Inc., and I should say I'm speaking with journalist Matt Taibbi about his book Hate Inc., Why Today's Media Makes Us Despise One Another, and I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. But you write about how the media, both progressive or liberal media,
right,
or right-wing media or mainstream media, has over the past several decades been fostering greater and greater division in society. And often that those divisions, that whole process has seemed pointless, although you conclude that maybe it's not. But clearly there are real divisions in society, some very, very stark divisions. I mean, wealth inequality is mm-hmm. one of the most obvious that springs to mind. How do you contrast the coverage of those sort of structural divisions within society with a kind of push to create conflicts, create what seem like debates and oppositional clashes on television or within the media system?
That's a great question. I think if you were going to have television that was reflected the actual divide in society, and I actually wrote a book called The Divide, and I think, for instance, Occupy Wall Street had an accurate take on what the actual divisions were in society, with the 99% and the 1%. It's rich versus poor, right? That's probably the more accurate description of what's going on in America. There are a few people who have tons of money. There's a huge pool of everybody else and who have similar problems. They may have different social viewpoints, but that grouping is very, very significant. You never see that represented in commercial news. They instead are showing you a representation of reality that allegedly shows basically America divided up into halves, into red and blue, right? We're divided along this stark line that has to do with our views on things like abortion or climate change or whatever it is. But they very, very seldom talk about our economic differences or the gap between the big corporate power in this country and the sort of large class of everybody else who has less economic security. So what I worry about with the press is like the crossfire representation of America, which is this cartoonized representation of political conflict in this country. And there's no pretense with shows like Crossfire was that this is anything but basically the political version of sports. It's just, you know, two people arguing about something, and the whole concept is that one person wins and the other person doesn't, and we're supposed to root for one side and not the other. And it's a consumer experience. We're watching it the same way we watch football. That's not what politics is about. Politics is real, and it's about very, very serious issues about who gets what and who controls the political processes and who has power and who doesn't. And I think we're just inaccurately portraying those differences on television. I think people are getting an unhealthy and inaccurate view of where the divisions really lay.
Well, let me ask you about your reflections on your own work
mm-hmm.
and the role that you've played as a best-selling journalist, somebody who is celebrated within liberal and progressive spheres of politics. How do you, looking back, see the role that you have played in this kind of turn toward hyper-partisan and cartoonish sometimes critiques that really miss the bigger picture?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I definitely talk about that in the book. This is one of the reasons why I started writing about this, because I was uncomfortable about my own role in this stuff. I mean, you have to think about it. I lived overseas for a long time. When I came home to the States from Russia in 2002, I remember going to a bookstore and going to the politics section, and there were two shelves. There was basically the Democrat politic books and the Republican politics books. And I thought to myself, wow, in order to write a book in this country, you have to basically forego half the audience off the bat. And I thought, that's so strange. There's no books for everybody. But that becomes part of your identity if you're in the media. You have to pick a side, and you have to choose to be marketed as one or the other, or else you can't benefit from the sort of gigantic messaging process that helps people sell books and sell their work. And so I've kind of grown up within the liberal side, the progressive side. And I worried about that throughout, because as a writer, you don't like to turn off everybody. You want to be able to address everybody. And, you know, in both for the magazine and in my books, I always had to be conscious of the fact that most of my audience was coming from one place and not the other. And, you know, inevitably, you start kind of playing to your audience a little bit too much. And I think the being out of the habit of trying to reach everybody is not healthy for journalists. I think it's and now, when it's not just being a little bit divided, now we actively say that you should never go on Fox News, you should never even acknowledge the legitimacy of that other audience. I think that's very bad for us, because it takes us out of the discipline of challenging our assumptions. And so, you know, I did always try to push back a little bit and, you know, cover potentially what the Democrats were doing wrong. Like, I covered the financial services industry for a long time. I tried to write about their role in the financial crisis, but it's become very difficult. Now really most of what we do in the media business is write about how one side or the other is bad, and I don't think that's healthy.
Do you think that the structures of journalism often also don't lend themselves toward complexity? And including the kind of journalistic tradition that you come out of, I mean, that kind of pungent tradition of take no prisoners,
right.
Very, very colorful. And yet, obviously, that complexity, the complexity of institutions or structures, often doesn't lend itself easily to that kind of writing.
Yeah, no, and that's absolutely true. Again, I spent probably 10 years writing about Wall Street and stuff like how the financial crisis happened, how the subprime mortgage crisis happened, what were credit default swaps, what were collateralized debt obligations. These are incredibly boring, arcane, complex topics. Why did Lehman Brothers collapse? All right, yeah, it's tons of legalese and jargon. So what I tried to do in my work was, I would use all the sort of fiction writing techniques, color, all those things, to try to sell the complexity. All right, so it's a challenge. You're trying to use the rhetoric to get people to take a journey they wouldn't otherwise take. However, the format of journalism doesn't really lend itself to that. I mean, I was lucky to get a lot of space and you know, to do 6,000-7,000 word articles about this or that. But most people don't have that. Most people who work in the business, if you work in TV, you get 7 sentences to do a story about whatever it is. And that's just not enough time to explain anything that matters in this country. And the unfortunate fact is that probably 95% of the content that we produce in the news business is just little bits of things that people see, headlines or short articles or TV episodes that can only scratch the surface, and that inevitably we get a cartoon version of reality, because we're not looking at, as you say, institutions are almost excluded from reporting because it's just too hard to talk about the Fed or to talk about, you know, how the EPA works or whatever it is. People just want to have a hot take, and then they want to move on to watching whatever else is they watch. And that, I think that's very, very bad for us.
Do you think that the demise of the long form is part of this? I mean, I feel very grateful to be able to broadcast on a program that is a long-form program, but that's really unusual within media. And the same is true within writing. And people are reading way fewer books and have turned to shorter pieces, though, of course, you could argue about what drove that in the first place.
Well, yeah, there's so many factors there, right? I mean, a lot of it has to do with just the way people are raised now. They're watching more video. Even the way we watch video is different than it used to be. You used to sit down, turn on the television, leave the channel on and watch it for a long time. Now people are scanning constantly. They don't like it, they move to something else immediately. So they don't have the attention span to even watch long documentaries, let alone read a book. So that's something you have to be conscious of. When I'm writing now, I know there's no, you know, 3-paragraph runway to the topic. You have to get them in the first sentence, or else they're not gonna keep reading. And That's tough, you know, especially again, if you have to work your way back to the core concept, which is that most political problems in this country are boring and difficult and institutional. How do you get an audience that is just not trained to deal with that to look at those things? And that's very difficult these days. As you say, you have an opportunity to do, you know, a 50-minute show. Most reporters don't have that, and that's unfortunate. You know, I don't know how we get back to that.
I want to ask you about how you see the kind of disillusionment that you referred to earlier within the public at large. You said that while people are consuming more and more media, they trust it less and less. A real paradox there. We spoke earlier about Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman's book, Manufacturing Consent, which is sort of a theme that runs through your book, Hate Inc.
I even talked to him.
And there's an interview with Chomsky included in the book. And for a lot of people who have engaged somewhat with manufacturing consent, they might conclude that a mistrust of the media is a good thing because the media is selling us lies. You argue, though, that that's a misreading of Chomsky and Herman. What do you think we should conclude about how we should relate to the media?
It's another great question. Chomsky talks about this, actually. He actually said that one of the things that he feels about manufacturing consent, and it's clearly he's very proud of that book, as he should be, but he's concerned that people drew the conclusion that the media is not to be trusted, you know, from reading that book. And I think what he was trying to say more is that people have to be more discerning about what they read. They have to be more educated about it. And you know, as he put it, newspapers are full of facts. I think even the worst news organizations, for the most part, try to avoid being openly factually wrong. Like they're still trying to avoid libel suits. They're trying to avoid slander, all these other things that we used to try to not get ourselves caught in. But you just have to be able, you have to be aware of what you're reading and what the context of those facts are. And you have to look out for whether they're being presented in an even-handed way, whether they're trying to push you towards one conclusion or another. That doesn't mean that you should ignore it entirely and dismiss everything and go read a conspiratorial site. It just means that, you know, there are things that you have to be aware of in the same way that you should be when you go to McDonald's. I mean, you know, are you going to eat that second hamburger? Maybe not. It's not a good idea. So it's a difficult thing. I mean, I don't know how we fix the media, but I don't think just completely tuning it out and giving up on trying to know what's going on in the world is the right solution either. So I think that's what he was trying to say, among other things.
Matt Taibbi is my guest. He is the author of Hate Inc., Why Today's Media Makes Us Despise One Another. That's published by Orr Books, and he's a correspondent for Rolling Stone. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So it's very hard to escape the media, even if we wanted to, and particularly in this extended electoral season that we find ourselves in right now. And I wanted to get your take on how you feel people should try and navigate that. I mean, you've written a lot about the 2016 elections and the role the media played in fueling Trump's rise, but also in some ways, I don't know if this is a word you would use, but sort of demobilizing the public in some sense. How do you feel like people should try and make their way through the months ahead of us?
I think the public is already had a lot of awareness. It's come to a lot of realizations about how presidential elections are covered. And that was one of the main takeaways from 2016, is that you saw these wide-scale revolts against quote-unquote establishment candidates on both sides. You would never have seen Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders getting that share of the vote in 2004. Neither of these candidates were what the campaign press would call presidential, right? Like I started covering presidential campaigns in 2004, and one of the first things I really focused on was the role of the campaign press in shaping how people thought about presidential candidates, and it was really a very closed bubble like kind of priesthood of people who spent too much time with one another. These are Washington and New York correspondents who had an idea of who got to be president and who didn't, and they spent a lot of their time telling audiences who was a good candidate and who was a bad candidate. They used all these code words, right? They would say so-and-so either looks or doesn't look presidential. So one person is nuanced, another person is pointed, like pointed is bad. Too professorial, that was another thing that was bad. So they were constantly saying that, trying to push us towards their conception of what a presidential candidate was. And that's how we ended up with people like John Kerry, who sort of fit the dictionary definition of what reporters thought a presidential candidate looked like. He was tall, white, athletic, threw a football around the tarmac with all the reporters, so they loved that. But at the same time, they called people like Dennis Kucinich, who, really tried to intellectually engage people on the campaign trail. They called him a kook and an eccentric, and all these things were disqualifying. Well, what we saw in 2016 is that just voters stopped listening to that stuff. We told them over and over again, and I say we as in the campaign press, that Donald Trump was an inappropriate choice, but so was Bernie Sanders. The press repeatedly said that this was not a serious person, and they kept defying these pronouncements. So I think it's not the public that needs to be educated about how to go forward. I think it's the news media just hasn't figured out yet that they're having a negative impact. Like when they're constantly trying to tell us how to think about things still, and they don't realize that people are actually responding negatively to that. We've seen this with a succession of Democratic candidates. They've tried to push in certain ways, and I think there's a gap there and a disconnect that hasn't been fixed. But in 2016. One of the reasons that they didn't see Donald Trump coming is because the press was spending too much time both with each other and with the candidates. So they were getting all their information from pollsters and from other pundits, and they didn't realize that there was this whole world out there that they weren't listening to. And I don't think that's changed enough going forward.
Do you think the way elections are decided has changed? You point out that we are told by the media, you choose. It's up to the people decide. Then there are those who point to elites shaping the choices that we have on offer and the way we take those choices. How do you see it? And did Donald Trump upend that, his election?
Yeah, I think he totally did. I think the formula in the past was really specific and pretty conservative. You had to have the campaign press, a whole bunch of sort of war chest of corporate donors behind you, and the backing of the party structure. If you had all those three things in alignment, you were probably going to win the nomination. And that was a tried and true formula that just hadn't been broken for decades going into the last election. Well, Donald Trump came in and he didn't have really any of those things. He raised half as much money as Hillary Clinton did. He had, I think it was two endorsements from major newspapers as opposed to something like 99 for Hillary. And he didn't really have the full-fledged backing of the Republican Party. There was a serious problem there. Like the RNC was holding back its volunteers at one point. They weren't advertising as much, and yet he won. I mean, he won with less of the popular vote, but it shows that you can break that cycle. And so this to me is just that's the big story of 2016. And you saw a similar thing almost happen on the Democratic side with the Sanders campaign. And I think it's changed. I mean, I think we used to talk about the invisible primary. And this is another thing I write about in the book, is that reporters even used to celebrate it. We would align all those forces ahead of time, and whoever got all that aligned was going to be the nominee. Well, that didn't happen last time. The Jeb Bush won the invisible primary and got three delegates. So it's different now. I don't know how to describe it, but it's different than it used to be.
Do you think that operates the same way on the Democratic side of it? I mean, Bernie Sanders obviously got a great deal of popular support, and yet he didn't become the candidate. The DNC was certainly not pro him. Do you think there are more constraints in terms of someone being able to make it coming from the left?
There are. Bernie also has, you know, a serious problem with the press. I mean, it's not really a secret that the big commercial media outlets don't particularly like Bernie Sanders, and they're not giving him the same kind of coverage that they would give other candidates. They're sort of almost comically at this point avoiding any kind of indication that he's doing well in the polls or anything. I mean, it's absurd at this point. You know, he was the leading fundraiser last quarter, which would normally be a big headline if it was for a candidate that, you know, was more approved of traditionally. But, you know, you didn't hear a whole lot about it. So he has a lot of obstacles with the audiences of papers like The New York Times, The Washington Post, CNN, MSNBC, because those are Democratic voters for the most part. So it's tough to overcome that. I think it's different from, you know, Donald Trump sort of circumvented the traditional media process. And also, he had lots of kind of friends in the media who liked him for reasons that didn't have a whole lot to do with politics. I mean, he schmoozed people, you know, even like Joe Scarborough, who wasn't really a Republican. Mika and Joe originally, they just kind of liked having Trump on set. He got a lot of coverage that way. And also, there was a point at which I think Republicans had tuned out the right-wing media a little more than I think Democrats have at this point. Like, they were a little bit kind of side-eyeing Fox News by the time Trump came around already, and being less enthusiastic about what they were told about people like Jeb Bush than I think Democrats are now. You know, I think there's still a little bit of a there's still a bond there with Democrats and these big media organizations that's tough to break.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time. Matt Sure. Taibbi, thank you so much.
No, thank you so much, Sasha.
Matt Taibbi is a correspondent for Rolling Stone. He is the author of many best-selling books, including Insane Clown President, and he is the author of Hate, Inc., Why Today's Media Makes Us Despise One Another, which is published by Orr Books. If you go to againstthegrain.org, you'll find a link to that book. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.